loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley, a Republican of Iowa, announced yesterday that for 4 years during the Obama administration, the CIA intercepted the emails of potential intelligence community whistleblowers and the emails of the Senate Intelligence and Judiciary Committees. Grassley said that he had known this was happening for 4 years, but the information was classified. It was finally declassified at his request last week. Grassley blames former CIA Director John Brennan and former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper by name for what appears to be an overtly illegal act. Next, President Trump offered remarks yesterday evening about immigration and the thousands of troops he's sending to the border. He said he hopes the military doesn't have to shoot, but he told reporters that he has told the military that if any migrants seeking asylum throw any rocks, that the military should consider the rock to be a rifle. Then, U.S. sanctions against Iran will take effect on Monday, 6 months after the Trump administration withdrew from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or Iran trade deal. The question, though, is what other countries will do about the sanctions and whether any waivers will make a difference. And then just hours after President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping had a positive phone call that pointed to an improvement in diplomatic relations, the Department of Justice issued indictments against two Chinese companies and three Chinese individuals yesterday for allegedly stealing trade secrets. What's behind the mixed signals coming from the U.S. government? And finally, it's Friday, so we will look at the week's worst, funniest, and most misleading headlines. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to the CIA spying on the Senate Judiciary Committee in a hunt for whistleblowers. Senate Judiciary Committee Chairman Chuck Grassley, a Republican of Iowa, announced yesterday that for 4 years during the Obama administration, the CIA intercepted the emails of potential intelligence community whistleblowers and the emails of the Senate Intelligence and Judiciary Committees. Grassley said that he had known that this was happening for 4 years, but the information was classified. It was finally declassified at his request this week. Grassley blames former CIA Director John Brennan and former Director of National Intelligence James Clapper by name for what appears to be an overtly illegal act. John Kiriakou, we normally would have a guest in, but guess what? You are the guest because you work for the CIA. You were a whistleblower. You went to prison because of the CIA torture program, not because you tortured, but because you told the people of this country and the people of the world that, in fact, the torture program existed. What better guest than you to talk about this amazing story? Were you surprised?
I was shocked when I read this. A friend texted it to me last night and asked me what I thought. I couldn't believe what I was reading because, as you noted in your introduction, this appears to be an overtly illegal act. What we have here is the CIA spying on American citizens. That is exactly what the CIA was doing in the 1960s and 70s that led to the creation of the Church Committee, which reiterated the illegality of the CIA spying on American citizens.
And they were spying on Americans, and they were spying on Americans, and they were spying on the oversight committees and
yes,
other congressional committees that had told Americans who had something to report in terms of waste, fraud, abuse, illegal conduct, in other words, whistleblowers. Those people thought they could come to these oversight committees and other congressional entities in confidence.
Which is what is supposed to happen.
And the CIA was willfully carrying out intelligence operations against them, the people, the whistleblowers, and Congress.
You know, there's already an internal policy at the CIA that was instituted after Ed Snowden went public with his revelations. And that is that all employees are actively encouraged to report on their coworkers. So if you suspect some kind of potential whistleblower activity from the guy that you sit next to, you're encouraged to go forward and say, I don't trust Joe next to me. I think he might become a whistleblower, so that they can begin spying on him. That's new. Well, this is even worse. At the CIA, NSA, FBI, at all the different intelligence community agencies, you're encouraged to go through your chain of command if you see evidence of waste, fraud, or abuse. And the chain of command is your boss, your boss's boss, the inspector general, the general counsel, and then the oversight committees. I mean, that's what we're taught to do. And so what we have here is evidence that people went through the chain of command when they saw waste, fraud, abuse, or illegality, and then they eventually went to the oversight committees and were spied upon. And it's not just that these Americans, that these Intelligence Committee employees were spied upon, but the congressional oversight committees were spied upon, at least the Senate Judiciary Committee and the Senate Intelligence Committee. And don't forget also that it was John Brennan who ordered CIA computer hackers to hack into the Senate Intelligence Committee's computer system when that committee was writing the torture report. And just to give you an idea of the unmitigated gall that John Brennan has, when he was busted for ordering his people to break into the Senate Intelligence Committee computer system, he had the nerve to file a crimes report against the committee, saying that the committee investigators had committed a crime by looking at documents that they otherwise weren't entitled to look at. Well, in response to that, the committee filed a crimes report against Brennan, and both crimes reports were dismissed, which is what Brennan's point was in the first place. That's what his goal was. Well, here you have something that's indefensible, and John Brennan is no longer the director of Central Intelligence, and James Clapper is no longer the director of National Intelligence. I'm anxious to see now if anybody has the guts or the stomach to file charges against these two guys.
The so-called anti-Trump resistance, not the grassroots Trump anti-Trump resistance that I, for one, am a part of, but for the elite anti-Trump resistance, John Brennan is one of those figures. He's on TV now. He's getting a big television contract, former CIA, to be like a news commentator.
Right.
He's going after the sitting president of the United States. Before that, it's clear that while he was appointed by President Barack Obama, he was actually going against the people in Congress and perhaps the Obama administration itself. Because let's face it, we were told and our kids are told, they all learn and we learned in school. This is a representative democracy. We elect the representatives. They are the chief representatives of we the people. Same with the president. We have a civilian form of government. The president of the United States, a civilian, is the commander in chief. The congressional oversight committees are over and seeing the intelligence operations. But what it's clear from this story is that it's really the intelligence committees that are over Congress, not vice versa.
Yeah, and that's really the important point here. The whole point of having an intelligence committee to oversee the CIA is that it's that committee that's supposed to ensure that the CIA doesn't continue to break the law. Before 1975, there were no congressional oversight committees for the CIA. And then coming out of the Church Committee, the order was to create the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, the SSCI and the HPSI. The members of those two committees are supposed to be the final arbiters of what the CIA can and cannot do, what is legal and what is illegal. They're not there to say, well, you know, I don't think this policy is a good idea. I don't think I like that operation. That's not their role at all. Their role is to say, stop, that's illegal. You can't do that. And then their role is also to advise appropriators on the intelligence community budget. But if you've got the CIA actively spying on their own overseers, then it corrupts our very democracy.
John Kiriakou is my co-host, but in this instance, you're also the guest here. We're talking about the CIA spying operation against the Senate committees that were taking the testimony, purportedly confidential testimony, of whistleblowers, people who wanted to report waste, fraud, and abuse. In other words, something the government was encouraging. When Barack Obama became president in 2009, he said he was for transparency and he was for, in defense of, supporting whistleblowers. Obviously, under his government, the opposite has happened. Brennan was a Barack Obama appointee. What happened? Was it all untrue from the beginning? What happened to Barack Obama in this?
I don't think it was untrue. I really believe that Obama believed that he was going to be the most transparent president in history. Those were his words. I believe that he believed he was going to be a champion for human rights. That ended up not happening. Neither one of those things ended up happening. And I think that the reason was that he surrounded himself with people who believed in the opposite. He surrounded himself with the likes of John Brennan, for example. Remember, before John Brennan was the director of the CIA, he was the number two at the National Security Council. He was the counterterrorism czar, so to speak. And so he was meeting with the president every single day. It was John Brennan that had this Nixonian obsession with leaks. To John Brennan, every leak was bad, and there was no difference between a leaker and a whistleblower. Well, of course, there's a huge difference between a leaker and a whistleblower. He didn't recognize any difference. And so the Obama administration ended up accounting for more whistleblower prosecutions than all previous presidents combined in history under the Espionage Act.
And let me just ask you, John, what happened to you when you revealed the CIA torture program on ABC way back in 2007? That was the Bush administration. They tried to prosecute you. They couldn't prosecute you or didn't prosecute you. But then it was under the Obama administration that your prosecution began once again. What was Brennan's role in that?
It was Brennan that had written to the Justice Department. After the Bush Justice Department decided that I had not committed a crime and they closed the case, Brennan became the number two at the NSC. And he wrote a letter to Eric Holder asking Holder, who was attorney general at the time, to reopen the case against me, which Holder did. And so the FBI investigated me for 3 more years. Before charging me with 5 felonies coming out of my whistleblowing.
And you went to prison for
2 years.
All right. Anyway, we're going to leave it there. Huge story, again, demonstrating, I would say, the fallacy of democracy, the fiction of our current political system, where it really is the CIA, not representative democracy, that has the power. Anyway, this is Brian Becker. I've been joined in studio, as I am every day, by John Kiriakou, normally the co-host of the show, but today our guest on this very, very important segment. You're listening to Loud and Clear. After a short break, we'll be right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou in studio with my co-host Brian Becker. President Trump offered remarks yesterday evening about immigration and the thousands of troops that he's sending to the border. He said he hopes the military doesn't have to shoot, but he told reporters that he's told the military that if any migrants seeking asylum throw any rocks, that the military should consider the rock to be a rifle. We're joined from San Diego by Pedro Rios. He's the director of the American Friends Service Committee's U.S.-Mexico Border Program, and he's the chairperson for the San Diego Immigrant Rights Consortium. Welcome back, Pedro. It's been a long time.
It has been. It's great to be back on the show.
We're happy to have you. I wanted to read you 2 questions and 2 responses from yesterday's press conference because they're chilling, and I think that this really puts things into perspective in terms of where the White House stands on this caravan policy. So the first question, and I should add, this is from the whitehouse.gov website. This is the official transcript. The question from a reporter is, in terms of your plans to change asylum, are you going to do this via executive order? And the president says, no, you don't have to release. You can just hold them. The problem is, to hold people, you need massive facilities. It's the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard of. Another country says, sorry, you can't come in. With us, we take their name, we take their phone number, we take their everything, and we say good luck, only because we don't have the facilities to hold people. But we're building the facilities now. We're building massive numbers of tents, and we will hold them in tents. But you don't have to release them. They released them only because they didn't have the facilities to hold them. That's one thing. I want to talk about that in a moment. The second question was this. Mr. President, you're saying rock throwing, like happened in Mexico, will be considered, and then the president interrupts the reporter and says, we will consider that the maximum, that we can consider that because they're throwing rocks viciously and violently. You saw that 3 days ago, really hurting the military. We're not going to put up with that. If they want to throw rocks at our military fights back. We're going to consider, and I told them, consider a rock a rifle. When they throw rocks like they did at the Mexico military and police, I say consider it a rifle. I have to get your comments first on this thing about the tents. What we're talking about here, what the president's talking about here, is a massive tent city somewhere in the desert, probably surrounded by barbed wire, concertina wire, whatever, to keep people in. Tell us how this is different from any previous president's policy on asylum, because that's what this is. This isn't just people streaming across the border just because they feel like it. This is about asylum. And we have laws and regulations in place on asylum. Go ahead.
Correct. I think it certainly is a chilling prospect to have hundreds, if not thousands, of people in what would appear to be internment camps. And we've seen this before, right before World War II, when Japanese Americans were interned, taken from their homes, losing all of their property, and interned in camps. We've seen this before, and it's unfortunately not the sort of history that I think any rational president of the United States would want to be returning to. And unfortunately, when people like Sheriff Joe Arpaio out of Maricopa County, who's no longer sheriff, a sheriff, but he did have people in very similar inhumane conditions of people in the desert camps, not necessarily having the right temperature to ensure their human rights were being respected. And so this is a slippery slope that will potentially place many people who are asylum seekers who have left their home countries because of fear and violence, and now will find themselves interned in camps without any real sense of how their humanitarian needs will be met. So it's different in the sense that it's a drastic proposal for a policy that potentially would be fraught with human rights violations.
I agree. The potential for human rights violations, I think, is just dreadful. Let's talk about this policy of shooting people who are throwing rocks. This is deja vu all over again, as Yogi Berra once said, because we see this happening all the time in Israel, where you've got a Palestinian throwing a rock and then an Israeli soldier or policeman opening fire. That doesn't look good on the evening news. And it's seen as really overdoing it when it comes to rock throwers. Does this president think that it's going to look any different if we start shooting people who throw rocks?
I'm not sure where Trump is getting the idea that responding with lethal force to rock throwers is an appropriate response. And certainly we don't know yet if that's going to be the scenario or if it's happened. But what we do know is that that has already played out along border communities. In fact, in 2005, a man by the name of Guillermo Rodriguez Martinez was shot in the back as he had climbed the primary border fence here in San Diego. The Border Patrol agent claimed that he was making a motion, had cocked his arm to throw a rock at him, but the autopsy later revealed that the entry wound was actually through the back. This man was able to climb over the fence and return to Mexico, but he died a few hours later. The agent in 2008 was found to be innocent of any charges, and so, you know, it was impunity again. And we've seen this time and again. We've seen a case where a 16-year-old was shot about a dozen times by Border Patrol agent Lonnie Schwartz in southern Arizona. Agent Schwartz claimed that this young man, Jose Antonio Elena Rodriguez, had thrown rocks at him. But again, the entry wounds were through the back. And so when it occurs, it's not the best type of media relations that the government would want to have. And obviously, the concerns are that if this becomes normal practice, where military trained for war are engaging people who might be throwing rocks, but engaging with deadly force, I think we are, again, entering a space that we have not been before, where it'll be okay to have a policy of shoot to kill people who are seeking asylum.
We're speaking from San Diego with Pedro Rios. He's the director of the American Friends Service Committee's U.S.-Mexico border program, and he's also chairman of the San Diego Immigrant Rights Consortium. I want to know, Pedro, how different this policy is than what we saw under the Obama administration. It's easy to jump up and down when we see a caravan coming and Donald Trump overreacting to the caravan. But it was Barack Obama who we called the deporter in chief. And I think the numbers are showing, at least so far at this early stage in the Trump presidency, that Trump has actually deported fewer people than Barack Obama did. Are we just more attuned to this issue, or is this administration worse?
You know, I think a lot of it has to do with the rhetoric that we hear coming out of the White House, that there's much more focus on issues of immigration and border But it's being done with such callous disregard for how the narrative is being put forward. And so, and it's become much more clear that the focus on immigration and border is to try to sway the midterm election. There's absolutely no doubt that that's a reasoning or a justification for so much focus on these days. Yesterday's speech by Trump had really no policy changes that were of any significance. It was just another opportunity to sway voters by engaging the audience with these topics that seem to be very drastic and very urgent. Yet we know that the larger caravan is more than 1,000 miles away. And so this idea of focusing on immigration and fabricating a boogeyman for non-border people really might turn them out and get them to the polls and say, yes, I want to vote for these candidates because they're going to do something about border security. When in fact, San Diego is the safest city in cities with populations of over 500,000 people. And so this notion of the border being out of control is really a fabrication of people who want to generate fear and use that fear to move people to vote, which is just a terrible way of engaging civil society in the United States.
In our last minute and a half or so, I wanted to ask you about comments that the Mexican ambassador to the United States made day before yesterday to the U.S. press. He was on MSNBC, and he said that that the size of the caravan has actually dropped by about half because the Mexican government is willing to resettle many of the migrants in Chiapas state in southern Mexico. There's manufacturing there. There's coffee production. There are actually jobs, and they need people to fill those jobs. And so many people are just electing to stay in Chiapas. Others may elect to stay in Mexico, but outside of Chiapas. What do you think the chances are that this caravan will just sort of go away in the coming weeks as it heads farther and farther north and people drop out because they're finding work in Mexico?
Yeah, I think those are interesting comments by Mexican ambassadors. And I think that on the one hand, a lot of the people who are dropping out of the caravan are doing so simply because they are really tired. It's grueling to be walking essentially a marathon every day with children without a lot of support. And so people are dropping off not so much because they are finding jobs, but simply because they can't take how grueling of a walk it is. And so that's much more realistic. And so there have been over 1,000 people who have from the caravan, I believe, who have accepted some sort of asylum claim or have placed forward an asylum claim. Not sure if Mexico has granted those yet. I think it takes much longer time than that.
We're going to have to end it there, unfortunately, Pedro. I'm sorry. We were joined from San Diego by Pedro Rios. He's the director of the American Friends Service Committee's U.S.-Mexico Border Program and chairperson for the San Diego Immigrant Rights Consortium. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
U.S. sanctions against Iran will take effect again on Monday, 6 months after the Trump administration withdrew from the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or Iran trade deal. The question, though, is what other countries will do about the sanctions and whether waivers will make a difference. We're joined from Tehran by Professor Hamid Mousavi, a professor of political science with the University of Tehran. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you for inviting me.
Professor, the Trump administration today granted waivers to 8 countries so that they can continue to trade with Iran. These are countries like Japan, India, South Korea. The Chinese are still negotiating a waiver. How is this going to affect Iran's overall economic health? Is this going to be enough trade to allow Iran to continue to grow economically?
Well, I think the Trump administration has somewhat backed up from its earlier goal of bringing Iranian oil exports to zero. And I think there are two main reasons for that. The first one being it is impractical in the short term. A lot of U.S. allies such as South Korea, Japan, as well as India have pressured Washington for waivers for several months now. And I think Washington has come to the conclusion that at least in the foreseeable future, it cannot bring Iranian oil exports to zero. The second factor is that there is very little spare capacity in the global oil market right now. So any attempt to bring Iranian oil exports to zero is going to have a considerable effect on the prices of oil worldwide. And I don't think that's something the Trump administration wants, especially right before the congressional elections, because it's going to lead to an increase in fuel prices.
We should add, too, just for our listeners, that these waivers, the waivers do not allow countries to just continue to trade with Iran forever. The waivers are meant to expire in 180 days to give these countries more time to wind down their oil trade with Iran. So your original point, I think, is correct, and it's important that the goal here is to choke the Iranian oil industry virtually to death.
That is true. So it seems that every 180 days, they are going to reduce the amount of oil these countries can import from Iran. Nevertheless, from Iran's perspective, I think it is a lifeline because there was a lot of expectations that starting from Monday, Iran was going to have major problems regarding its oil exports. We have to understand that oil exports are the main lifeline of Iran's economy. That's where most of the government's revenue comes from. So it is very important, and it impacts all over the Iranian economy. I think it also, perhaps, and optimistically speaking, it also provides an opportunity, perhaps, for negotiations between Iran and the United States. But that is something that we have to wait and see.
The price of oil has gone up dramatically, and Hamed is right. If the United States succeeded at completely choking off Iranian oil, which is their stated goal, in fact, the oil prices that have gone up dramatically, and that's lead to inflationary pressures in all other commodities, because clearly oil is the central artery of the world economy, that would have the effect of raising prices even more. And of course, in a short time, in a short period of time, if oil prices go up, if petroleum products go up, Americans also feel that pretty quickly at the gas pump, something almost all, certainly all drivers in the United States, and that, you know, that's a big part of the population, will feel directly and immediately. Hamed, I want to ask you, though, right now, inside Iran, given the fact that the Trump administration has limitations or restraints on its very, very, very hostile policy towards Iran because of the issue, say, of oil prices and how it impacts even people here in the United States and thus their political fortunes. All that said, what's the mood in Iran? What's the feeling in Iran? And what's the impact so far on the Iranian economy?
Yes, yeah, so the pressure of sanctions, I mean, it's felt all over Iran, and especially by poorer classes in Iran. We have to understand that sanctions really hurt ordinary people rather than the government. And the pressures have increased in recent months. I mean, the Iranian currency, the rial, has lost over 70% of its value in the past 6 months. Nevertheless, at the same time, I feel that a lot of Iranians are putting this blame on the Trump administration rather than on their own government, which I think is what the Trump administration is aiming for. And the reason for that is the current nuclear deal that we have is the result of several years of intense diplomacy. And it's a deal that is both backed by virtually the entire international community, including the Europeans. It's also backed up by a UN Security Council resolution, meaning that it's international law. And according to the IAEA, which is the sole authorized party to inspect Iranian facilities, Iran has fully obliged by its side of the deal. Nevertheless, all of this did not stop the Trump administration from withdrawing from the deal. Now, the Trump administration is saying we are doing all of this in order to renegotiate a better deal. And I don't think this is a good strategy, because if you want to renegotiate a better deal, then you have to abide by the current deal, and hopefully that will lead to more cooperation. If you scrap the current deal, which it has already done since 6 months ago, what that leads to, it leads to a lot of mistrust from the Iranian side towards the Trump administration. So if you talk to a lot of Iranian analysts, they would say, how can we trust the Trump administration in abiding by a new deal when they are not even, you know, keeping up their side of the agreement under the current deal. And I don't think this is good either for Iran or the United States.
Professor, tell us a little bit about Bandar Chabahar, the port in Chabahar. We talked about this on the show earlier in the week, and it seems that the sanctions are really going to hit the Indians here at Chabahar because they've invested so much in making it into a world-class ocean-facing port. So what do you think is going to happen there?
Does this waiver for India include a waiver for the port?
Right, which would be the most important thing.
Well, the details of the waivers are still not out. They are going to be released on Monday. Nevertheless, you point to a very important issue, and that is the importance of India in today's global politics. India is important both for Iran and the United States. I mean, the U.S. administration, starting from a year ago, they started to change their rhetoric, and instead of using the term Asia-Pacific, which they had been using for a very long time, they started to use the term Indo-Pacific, which pointed to the importance of India and its allies in confronting a rising China. And that is why India is very important for the United States, and that is partly why the U.S. is granting these waivers to India. Now, for Iran, India is its second biggest buyer of its oil, and that is why Iran has tried in recent years to improve its relations with India. And the Chabahar port, which is actually a joint project between Iran, India, and Afghanistan, is, I think, part of that strategic alliance. And it's also, as you said, it's going to hopefully become a major transit hub in the region.
Yeah, Ahmed, there's also Afghanistan, because clearly this port and the Pentagon's own view of what's going on in Afghanistan, which is even today, the head of the U.S. military forces in Afghanistan said, weirdly, that, but not wrongly, that there is, quote, no military solution in Afghanistan. Obviously, over the years, as we look forward, the reconstruction of Afghanistan is significant, of course, mainly for the Afghan people, but it's also significant for the Pentagon from a geostrategic and military strategic point of view. For that purpose, this port in Iran and India in particular were slated to play a major role. I just talk about the military implications of this.
Right. So I think actually the issue of Afghanistan is one of the issues where Iran and the United States, they share a lot of interests. If we put the extremist foreign policy of Donald Trump aside, a stable Afghanistan is very good both for the United States, because an unstable Afghanistan is going to lead to the rise of terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda. In an unstable Afghanistan is also very bad for Iran, because we share a very long border with Afghanistan. And the Taliban was the enemy of both Iran and the United States. So I think that is one area of possible future cooperation between the two countries. Now, today, unfortunately, Afghanistan is a total mess. And the Chabahar port has the potential to bring economic benefits to Afghanistan. However, the sanctions that the Trump administration is implementing is actually going to harm these perspectives. I mean, the Chabahar port, I don't think it can reach its full potential with the sanctions coming on Monday, because the sanctions that come on Monday don't only impact oil and gas. They also target Iran's financial institutions. And financial institutions are, of course, the core of any sort of trade. I mean, if your banks cannot cooperate with banks overseas, then that is going to bring, you know, trade to a halt.
Yes, it absolutely will. We're going to have to leave it there. That was the voice of Professor Hamid Mousavi, a professor of political science at the University of Tehran. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Just hours after President Trump and Chinese President Xi Jinping had a positive phone call that pointed to an improvement in diplomatic relations, the Department of Justice issued indictments against two Chinese companies and three individuals yesterday for allegedly stealing trade secrets. What's behind the mixed signals coming from the U.S. government? We're joined from San Francisco by David Ewing. He's the chair of the San Francisco chapter of the U.S.-China People's Friendship Association. Welcome, David.
Thanks for having me back.
David, are we looking at a strategy coming out of the White House to keep the Chinese off balance, or is this a case of the right hand not knowing what the left hand is doing?
It might be a case of an election coming on Tuesday, so I'm really unsure. But you know, I think many of the things that the U.S. government has done in the past few months, you know, there have been a number of arrests of Chinese scientists accused of, it's like they are in the Micron case, accused of giving trade secrets to the Chinese and things. And then the charges all get dropped later, and the government ends up losing the cases in court. So all this, it reflects the tension, I think, with China. And I think maybe President Trump thinks that for the purposes of energizing his base for Tuesday, it makes sense to do this. The stock market has been whipped by this, even today. You know, there was talk that there was a, based on the phone call, that there'd be a deal. Then Larry Kudlow, the advisor, said, no, there's no deal, and the stocks went down. So it's really, we're in such an, the U.S. is so politically unstable this week, and it's just hard to know what the government's going to do.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Global Times, which is a newspaper, a website that's not the official Communist Party of China. It's privately owned, but it reflects frequently the views of the Chinese Communist Party unofficially. The lead op-ed is entitled, "Sincerity from U.S. Better Than Carrot and Stick Scheme," meaning they're suggesting that the U.S. is playing hard cop, soft cop, that Trump says at one moment, hey, we had a great conversation, we can work it out, we'll talk when we get to the G20 summit, we're ready for negotiations. And like minutes later, the Department of Justice announces the indictment of Chinese people and Chinese companies for industrial sabotage.
Right.
Carrots and sticks.
This is the drumbeat, right? That all of the growth of the Chinese economy has been at the expense of the U.S. economy. That's sort of the playbook for at least for the last week or 2 weeks or so.
And which is kind of amazing when you think about it. So American companies went to China, and like nobody compelled them to go. They went because it's a huge market. One out of every four human beings is Chinese. The Chinese government lets them come in and sell like all kinds of stuff and also build factories and hire Chinese labor at very low wages so that those same corporations can then assemble the products, late stage assembly phase of production, ship them overseas. Thus, it has a made in China label, even though it might have been made by an American corporation using low wage Chinese labor. And then the Trump administration is saying, see how the Chinese are using us? I mean, really, when you think about what's actually happened, it's completely the opposite. China has allowed them in and they've accepted it because they can make lots of money.
You know, there's one difference, though, that I think the thing that's really galling to political leaders, and by the way, I'm sure you know that Bernie Sanders has always been in favor of sanctions. He's a liberal, you know, the liberal Democrats, and there have been talk of sanctions for years, and then going back a very long time. And the Democrats have always promoted sanctions, not just Republicans. But what I think what's really galling is that, you know, it's true, China opened its labor markets to foreign investors, and it helped China develop. But China required conditions on any investor in China. You had to provide technological assistance to the local Chinese state companies. So yes, you could go ahead, you could develop an auto plant or steel plant, you can get steel workers, but you had to do a transfer technology. At some point during the course of the deal, you had to transfer technology to the Chinese. China had the economic power to do that because its markets are so big. And it has a socialist government that's very determined. It's the only developing country that was able to do that. In other developing countries, the U.S. can come in and doesn't have to do any technology transfers. It can set the terms of labor and everything else. But because of the attractiveness of the Chinese market and the determination of the party in China, they were able to wrest these concessions. And that's what I think Trump complains about all the time.
I think that's right. I think that's exactly right, in fact. Most of the governments in sort of the developing world, whether they're in the Middle East or Africa or Latin America, I mean, there's two ways that the world economy works. You either get foreign investment from the major countries and the major companies, or you get sanctioned by those countries. So you're either sanctioned and deprived of access to markets and capital, or they invest. And most governments, thus, are desperate for investment in order to thrive, in order to be able to feed their own people. Here you had the Chinese government. The Chinese state was big enough, strong enough, and the market was big enough and strong enough as a bargaining chip that they could say to the Western companies, yeah, you can come in, you can make lots and lots of money, but you can't simply do it only on your terms. We're going to impose terms on you. And now those same, well, it's not really the same companies. The governments of those countries are chafing and saying, how dare the Chinese try to break up the monopoly on technology held by imperial countries? How dare China actually want to have the capacity to develop on its own? In other words, they have its own capacity to be self-determining. How dare they? They treat the Chinese as if they're like insubordinate colonial slaves just because they insisted on those kind of terms. Go ahead.
And the Friday before the election is the perfect time to do that. I mean, to fire up a right-wing base, isn't it? It's just the perfect timing. So that's why I think that politics are unstable at the moment, and things will probably stabilize much more after Tuesday, and then we'll see what happens.
Yeah, well, that'll be the thing, John, whether or not this trade war really becomes a trade war, which it seems to, or whether Trump will go right to the brink, make some kind of deal with China. China makes some concessions. Maybe they'll even be cosmetic concessions. And then Trump can say, my hard line art of the deal.
That seems to be the pattern. That's what he did with the Canadians. That's what he did with the Mexicans, the South Koreans. He's trying to do it with the European Union.
Minor tweaks in trade relations. And then Trump can say, see, everybody, I'm bringing jobs back to America.
Declare victory and go home.
So we had this discussion with Xi Jinping. Trump came off and said, looks good. You know, when Larry Kudlow came out yesterday and said, looks like we're going to, I can't remember his exact language, but the indicator was that things were going to get better between the U.S. and China. And then hours later, the Justice Department on Thursday announced that it charged three individuals and two Chinese-backed companies with theft of trade secrets. And it was Attorney General Jeff Sessions, Trump's attorney general himself, who unveiled a new initiative targeting economic espionage by China, meaning probably carrying out FBI investigations in almost every state against Chinese students, Chinese nationals, and making some other arrests in what Jeff Sessions calls a brazen scheme. Anyway, again, David Ewing, how will the Chinese people interpret that indictment, or how will the Chinese government, more importantly, interpret the indictment?
I think, you know, they see it as a political, it's a strongly politically oriented series of measures, but I think the Chinese see them as mostly directed at internal politics in the U.S. more so than at them. But, you know, the economic consequences are bad for China, and the Chinese government is steeling itself for a more difficult, maybe slower growth period ahead if trade with the U.S. tanks. And trade is tanking now. We've just seen the third quarter just finished on Wall Street. So the Wall Street companies made their reports this past week. And there sort of seemed to be a slowdown in some of them. But if you look at where the sanctions were targeted, for example, at Chinese steel, the steel stocks were down about 49%. The trade war was supposed to help steel companies because it raised Chinese steel prices by 25%. And that raised prices in the U.S. But the steel consumers, the construction business, just stopped buying steel. They're just not going to buy it. They think they can hold out until there is a break in the trade war. So the steel companies are had a bad quarter, and they're going to have a much worse quarter ahead. So it's all sort of kind of backfiring, but we won't see the results because the reporting are really business reports on Wall Street are by quarter. So it won't hit until the next quarter. We really see what damage has been done by the trade war, at least in the U.S. But China is preparing right now.
Yeah. And John, we know, as we talked about in the last day or two, the Ford company and other auto manufacturers are being hurt because the costs of steel and the costs of aluminum, those...
They've been quite vocal about these painful sanctions.
Ford has actually offered 18,000 salaried employees a buyout as a consequence of its inability to continue to function at this pace, largely because of the increased price or the increased cost of production, largely because of the tariffs. So... You might find some winners in tariffs. Obviously, there are some. Otherwise, Trump wouldn't be doing it and portraying it as a great thing. But there are clearly losers, too. And I think David Ewing is correct because he's suggesting, you know, there are going to be real losers, maybe big-time losers, but they won't know it or we won't know it because the quarterly reports won't come out until after the midterm elections.
That's right. We're going to have to leave it there. We were joined from San Francisco by David Ewing. David is the chair of the San Francisco chapter of the U.S.-China People's Friendship Association. We have a lot more coming up, so stay tuned to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
And clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
It's Friday, so we'll look at the week's worst, funniest, and most misleading headlines. Joining us from the San Francisco Bay Area is Steve Pat. He's an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog, and you can go there to catch up on all the headlines that we couldn't get to. And we're joined here in the studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Russell. Welcome back, both of you.
Thanks so much.
Hi, everybody.
Steve, there are a lot of headlines in the worst and most disgusting category this week. And I want to start with one that was taken out of Newsweek. Tell us about that.
Yeah, well, with Trump's latest announcement about firing on people who are throwing rocks, this one becomes all the more relevant and all the more scary. The headline reads, DHS Secretary Kirstjen Nielsen says U.S. has no plans, quote, right now, quote, to shoot at caravan.
Well, that's a relief.
I think she was saying this theoretically to be calming. Like, I think in her own head, she thought she was like mollifying the reporters because they were like, why are you bringing military down there? And she's like, oh, no plans right now to shoot.
Yeah.
Doesn't make any sense.
These people are, well, I don't know. I'd say they're lacking in political savvy or they're talking. Here's what it is.
Okay. What is it, Brian?
It's not the absence of political savvy. That's not it.
Not the absence of political savvy. Okay.
It's that she wants to tell the media, we're not going to shoot the caravan people, but she doesn't want to anger her boss, Donald Trump. So she says, right now we don't have plans. What do you think about that? I mean, I think that's what it is. What do you think, John?
I think that's it. I think that's it. This was like a coded message almost.
Yeah. By the way, it's a war crime.
It is.
And a crime against humanity to shoot.
Have the military open fire on civilians, unarmed civilians.
Yeah. And if they throw a rock, that too, you can't shoot people dead because somebody's throwing a rock.
That's right.
That's an international criminal act. Steve Pat, let's go on.
Well, here comes a scary headline and really insulting to anyone's intelligence. From the New York Times, the newspaper of record, with North Korean threats looming, the U.S. Army pursues controversial weapons. So, really? North Korea and South Korea are busy disarming the DMZ, and yet we're told that North Korean threats are looming? Well, the interesting thing is, if you read the article, there isn't a single word in the article to back up that headline, which just says there's a looming threat like it's a fact. There's nothing in the article about the threat. It's all about these quote-unquote controversial weapons, and it's really just a justification for the Department of Defense and the Army to justify these weapons. And what are these weapons? They're cluster bombs. Cluster bombs, which are banned by a treaty signed by 104 countries, which, needless to say, does not include the United States. So it's just a disgusting article.
John Kiriakou, I'm glad Steve included this headline. With North Korean threats looming, this is, as he's pointing out, at the moment they're dismantling the weapons in the DMZ. They're actually demilitarizing the demilitarizing the demilitarized zone. The U.S. Army pursues controversial weapons. Let's just help the audience understand, what's a cluster bomb?
Oh, a cluster bomb is a terrible thing. It's a bomb that contains hundreds of smaller bomblets. And so when you drop it and it opens, it sends little bombs all over the place. Well, not all of them go off. Some of them remain intact. And children often think that they're toys. And so if a child in Afghanistan or Iraq or Palestine or wherever sees this little ball and sees it as something to play with, he'll often pick it up and then either die in the explosion or have his arms or hands blown off in the explosion. These are very, very dangerous things. They've been condemned by the United Nations for many years. And we're one of the very few countries that still uses them.
Yeah, U.S., Israel dropped hundreds of thousands of cluster bombs. So they come down as a bomb, and then they break off into hundreds and then thousands, if you have many of them, little bomblets. And when they scatter all over the area, they don't distinguish between civilian and soldier. Guess what? The little bomblets can't. These are anti-personnel weapons. These weapons are a violation of the Geneva Convention. Mm-hmm. So at the very moment that North Korea and South Korea are trying to have peace break out in the Korean Peninsula, this ridiculous, disgusting, imperialist New York Times headline reads, "With North Korean threats looming, the U.S. Army pursues controversial weapons," which indicates that the Pentagon has reversed course because earlier last year they pledged to get rid of these weapons.
Why does the U.S. get to do this? They're the only country that gets to do this, and Israel.
It's the 700-pound gorilla syndrome. They can because they can, because nobody's stopping them. The Korean people don't want Korea to have cluster bombs all over it. They want to get rid of these bombs. Anyway, disgusting headline. Agreed. Steve, let's go on.
Well, from one disgusting headline to another, this one's from my local Mercury News, but had similar headlines appeared elsewhere. This is about the two black people who are gunned down in a grocery store parking lot, I believe. Two die in grocery store shooting. Race might have played a role. Might have? This is reminding everybody that this killer, after he killed these two black grandparents, there was an armed white man there, and the killer said to him, "Don't shoot me. I won't shoot you. Whites don't shoot whites." And just prior to shooting these two black people, he had tried to break into a black church and possibly kill people there, but he couldn't get into the church. And yet, in the headline, race might have played a role.
Yeah, that's disgusting. And also, this happened right before the Pittsburgh massacre. And here, this guy was trying to break into the church to carry out a massacre just like the one in Pittsburgh or the one that Dylann Roof carried out in South Carolina. He was going to go in and massacre black parishioners. He ran into these two elderly African-American couple. He slaughtered them. Race may have played a factor. I mean, it's awful.
It's just we've done this for years where we just paint over what's actually going on. And I'm so glad that at least some media is covering it, but this kind of media coverage is disgusting. It's absolutely disgusting.
All right, let's go on.
The next one is from the Washington Post, and we're back to Russiagate again. Mail bomb suspect, that's Cesar Sayoc, if I get his name right. Mail bomb suspect made numerous references on Facebook to, quote, Russian associates and echoed pro-Kremlin views.
Now, this is the guy who sent pipe bombs to Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and John Brennan and many other Democratic Party officials or high visible people who have opposed Donald Trump. So go ahead.
So who are these Russian associates ominously mentioned in the headline? Well, if you read the article, they're actual Russians. He knows. Turns out, and I'm going to read from the article, he lives in an area of suburban Miami with a large Russian community, meaning the Russians described on the Facebook page may have simply been friends of that nationality. In fact, there's pictures of him with these friends on the page. They're not some ominous Russian agents. They're just friends of his who happen to be Russian Americans. And his pro-Kremlin views, which are, you know, highlighted like he's, again, pushing Kremlin propaganda, he supports the Syrian and Russian effort in Syria to get rid of the terrorists, Al-Qaeda and ISIS. By the way, the Washington Post puts terrorists in quotes because they don't want you to think that Al-Qaeda and ISIS are actual terrorists. It's astonishing.
I mean, I think the most ridiculous thing here is that there is so much to talk about that's, you know, if the news really needs something big and flashy that's really disgusting, there's plenty about Cesar Sayoc that's disgusting. That his van was covered in, you know, anti-black, anti-Jew, like, you know, just really hateful messaging, pro-Trump messaging. Talk about that. There's plenty there. Why go into this stuff that doesn't even make sense, that there's no real connection to anything here?
Yeah, it's awful because it's just, it's a witch hunt. I mean, and so if the guy, if the guy had done anything associated with any Russian whenever, that was going to become the headline, because somehow Russia was to blame for the pipe bombs going to political officials. But you know what? The Democratic Party, and I think John Brennan, and I think the intelligence community, they're perfectly cool with that.
Oh, yeah. Without a doubt.
Misleading doesn't matter here.
No.
Because it feeds the narrative.
Exactly. I'm just going to point out again that the headline talks about references on Facebook to Russian associates. And he talks in Facebook about his Russian brothers, but he also talks about his Italian brothers because he has Italian friends. They don't bother to mention that in the headline because it doesn't fit the narrative. It doesn't fit the, you know, the witch, doesn't push the witch hunt narrative. It's just disgusting, really.
Associates are like oligarchs. You can only have Russian associates and Russian oligarchs. They don't have anything else.
That's true. 1 minute left, Steve.
Let's change the tone here. This was from yesterday. This is from the Wall Street Journal. Pence reminds celebrities that people know him. Pence was all upset because Oprah came to Atlanta to campaign for Stacey Abrams, and he was feeling outstage, and like, you know, people thought Oprah was more important than more of a crowd pleaser than poor old Mike Pence.
He leaned forward, he said, I'd like to remind Stacey and Oprah and Will Ferrell I'm kind of a big deal too.
Did he actually say that?
Yeah. That's the Vice President of the United States, a heartbeat away from the White House, a heartbeat away.
People know me, okay?
John, I think we're out of time.
We're out of time, unfortunately. We were joined from the San Francisco Bay Area by Steve Pat. Steve is an independent journalist whose critiques of the mainstream media have been a feature of his blog, Left Eye on the News. Steve tweets at Left Eye Blog, LeftEyeBlog. And if you go there, you can catch up on all the headlines we couldn't get to, and there are always a lot of them. We were also joined here in the studio by Sputnik News analyst and producer Nicole Russell. You've been listening to Loud and Clear. We're completely out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear.
Oh, heart.